Hello and welcome to I'll Look Into It. I'm your host, Tony Yang. Today we're examining some of the history of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Our guest is Sherry Buchanan. She is a publisher, editor, and author of the new book on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, The Blood Road, The Women Who Defended It, The Legacy. Before she created Asia Inc., she worked for the Wall Street Journal and the International Herald Tribune in Brussels, Paris, London, and Hong Kong. Reviewer Myra McPherson, author of The Long Journey, writes that Sherry takes us on the Ho Chi Minh Trail in a riveting and as a relevant journey today as it was 50 years ago. She charts new territory, especially in the vivid, often heartbreaking stories of women who fought in the war as teenagers and the forced roles of housewives who stood on the rooftops to shoot down U.S. planes that bombed their homes. Her vibrant writing and crystal clear interviews with women, their youthful dreams, and present-day realities shine a powerful light on a war and a previously unexplored dimension that should never be forgotten. Welcome and thanks for joining us from the UK, Sherry.
Thank you, Tony, for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. You start the book with a historical narrative of the war and then discuss your personal trip along the trail. My question is, what inspired you to take that journey?
Well, I wanted to raise awareness about the war's legacies and about our responsibility to fix the harm that we did. People don't often know what happened. They've forgotten, or they only hear one side, usually our side. So I did the road trip to follow the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Vietnam and Laos and collect stories along the way, especially from the women who defended it against U.S. bombings. Just to step back for a second, North Vietnam built the Ho Chi Minh Trail to unify North and South Vietnam, who were divided at the time. The signatories of the 1954 Geneva Accords had promised unification, but that promise was not kept. Why? Because South Vietnam and the U.S. didn't want a unified Vietnam under communist leadership. So communist-led North Vietnam sent weapons, manpower, ammunition, and food down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to their supporters in South Vietnam. On its side, the U.S. set out to cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail to stop it, and with it, the spread of communism from North to South Vietnam. So what did we, the U.S., do to cut the trail? We carpet-bombed the Ho Chi Minh Trail, dropping 7.6 million tons of bombs. As a result, unexploded bombs litter Vietnam and continue to maim and kill. So one thing I did was to walk through the bomb fields in Quang Tri province to see how teams today decommission cluster bombs. And I can tell you it's very, very dangerous work. A highly experienced team leader I went out with, sadly, was killed a year later. The next thing we did, or at the same time, we sprayed 20 million gallons of Agent Orange to destroy jungle cover and kill crops to deny food to the enemy. I think that's been a war crime since 1919. As a result, up to 3 million Vietnamese suffer health effects from Agent Orange. On the trip, I visited one family with three children, and all three were severely handicapped due to exposure to the toxic chemical that is still present in the water table and will stay there for probably another 100 years. Finally, the civilian death toll was absolutely off the scale. An estimated 2 million civilians in Vietnam and hundreds of thousands more in Laos and Cambodia were killed during the war. We admit to killing 30,000 in collateral damage, which is unintentional and no responsibility. But we need to revisit that number and our responsibility for the ones that we did kill. So along the trail, I specifically set out to meet the women who had defended it against what was one of the most extraordinarily intense bombings in modern times. These women are celebrated in Vietnam, but their story is largely unknown in the U.S., and I think their history deserves to be told. To give you an idea of the numbers, in North Vietnam, 100,000 youth volunteers were posted on the trail, far away from home, under bombs in napalm in terrible jungle conditions. Another estimated 1.7 million women defended their land, villages, and factories close to home. And in South Vietnam, almost a million women joined the Viet Cong to fight for reunification against the U.S.-backed South Vietnamese government who opposed it. So in the book, I addresses some of these questions, but I also wanted to open the door to further investigation and academic discourse on this topic that's been covered mainly from our side and from another different perspective. As an example, for example, was the U.S. carpet bombing of North Vietnam genocide? Was it intentional? There are just so many questions that haven't really been asked, even though this war has been covered extensively. There's still a lot to be told.
Yeah, I mean, it's been fraught with all sorts of, you know, sensitivities and, you know, patriotic fervor, I think, as well, rather than having something that's particularly objective. And I love your particular angle in entry into this is about the women along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the gender differences and the recollection for the men and women along the trail? I think that was very pronounced in your book, because the women have, and this is always true when we talk about any particular war, the women have a very different recollection than the men. But I found yours fascinating because it's not about the home front. It's about the women who are actually in the middle of the war on the trail with the carpet bombing going on. And just to add on, more bombs were dropped in Vietnam, just in Vietnam, than the United States and the Allies dropped on the Axis powers in World War II. So, I mean, just the scale of bombing was at another level.
It was at another level. I have to say, I was struck, first of all, by how both men and women remembered were willing to talk about their traumas. It seemed that the worst recollection for all of them was seeing their buddies killed every single day, and every single day picking up body parts blown up by bombs. They had nightmares, and some had survivor's guilt. And both men and women were willing to talk about that. But as you say, women platoon leaders did talk more about the well-being of their teams than about the battles men usually remembered. They talked about their teams being hungry and sick and how they had to take care of them. Malaria was rife in the jungle. Sometimes they went crazy. They had to find food, clothing, and medicine, as well as use their weapons to defend themselves and their teams. Was this a gender difference? I think partly, but it was also because of the women's tasks. The men were on the move to get to the southern battlefronts. The women were posted at the trail stations, so the well-being of their platoons was essential to keep those truck convoys moving south. So, for example, women were in charge of repairing the roads bombed every day, of rebuilding bomb tunnels and shelters, decommissioning unexploded bombs, hugely dangerous work, burying the dead, and transporting ammunition. So, in a way, their caring roles were for the benefit of their teams and of the goals of the war. But some did choose caring roles over killing roles when they could, and perhaps men would have done the same given the choice. We don't know. As an example, Hoang Thi Mai asked to be trained as a sniper when she was only 15. She was so full of hatred for the enemy who had bombed her village and killed her father. But 7 years later, sickened by the human suffering she witnessed, she retrained as a nurse to care for the wounded. And so in the space of one war, she went from killer to caregiver. And perhaps that's a kind of universal lesson from this war, from the North Vietnamese side, how they had to be both killers and carers to defend their home soil.
Yeah, I mean, that story strikes me a lot, because I think people don't also recall that the war went on for a very protracted period of time. as well, because I think it's America's long, well, until the recent wars in Afghanistan, it's America's longest war. Certainly the casualties are much higher, I think, in Vietnam. And so that's kind of interesting. And also just how long, I think American soldiers could, you know, do their 1 year of service and leave, right, generally speaking. And meanwhile, these Vietnamese are being consistently bombarded for years. So that starts, that's very interesting and always mindful to kind of point out along the way. What were some of the narratives, maybe two or three, that really kind of stood out to you along your journey? They're very rich narratives. I love how these people who are veterans of this conflict kind of opened up and just told you stories about, you know, specific parts of the trail and what happened. But what really stood out to you as you're going along this journey?
Well, I guess the women's stories about defending their home territory were the ones that stood out the most. The stories illustrated bravery, suffering, and also the disproportionate strength between U.S. and North Vietnamese forces. I mean, we're superiorly, technologically superior nation, and North Vietnam had backing from the Chinese and the Soviet Union, but they were really at a disadvantage compared to us. So the story of the defender of the Dragon Shaw Bridge is one that stands out. A 17-year-old Nguyen Thi Thu Yen, who weighed 98 pounds, carried 260 pounds of ammunition in one go to anti-air defense teams running out of bullets. And she was under fire during those 2 days in 1965. There were 69 U.S. Air Force and Navy fighter bombers attacking the bridge, and they dropped about 420 bombs, and these bombs weighed 750 pounds each. Now, I can't imagine any of this, but I do think the numbers are so amazing to think that this young girl was ferrying back and forth from a silted river up to the anti-aircraft defense units who were defending the bridge. And by the way, the U.S. never managed to put the bridge out of action after 800 sorties until finally in, I think it was 72, they had a guided missile that did it in. So the next one was the defender of the Mujia Pass, who talked about her time working on the most dangerous stretch of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, attacked day and night, and it gives you an idea of what we were sending down there: cluster bombs, people sniffer bombs that looked like trees and detected body heat, which meant that the women had to get onto the open road because they could be detected in the jungle, and that meant they were not undercover, magnetic bombs and 1,000-pound bombs delivered by B-52s. 10 out of 16 in her platoon were killed. She was wounded by shrapnel but kept looking for her friends' bodies because she said she didn't want to let them die naked. And I think that's testimony to the caring side of these women soldiers.
Yeah. I'd like to remind you that you're listening to I'll Look Into It with Tony Yang. Today, we're talking with author Sherry Buchanan, discussing her trek along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. One of the things, you know, and you've been discussing this, a lot about the book is about the consequences of military action in Vietnam, the collateral damage. What do you think we need to address the consequences of military actions in Vietnam? I mean, the two things, I mean, between the bombing and Agent Orange in particular, I think those things are coming to the forefront of people's minds when we think about Vietnam now rather than the war itself.
Yeah, they are. Well, I have to say that since 2014, the U.S. government has taken some positive action, but nowhere near enough. For example, it has funded the cleanup of one of the worst Agent Orange hotspots at Da Nang Air Base, and done a partial cleanup of Bienhua, but without talking about war reparations or war crimes, at the very least, we should fund the cleanup of 26 additional dioxin hotspots in Vietnam. And we can also provide compensation equal to that given to American Vietnam veterans, to the Vietnamese in Vietnam, and to the American Vietnamese and American Laotians in the U.S., whose health has been affected by Agent Orange. There is a bill in Congress that would do some of that. So that's definitely something we can do right now and should do. I think we should also investigate how many civilian deaths we're responsible for. And finally, Biden wants to return to American exceptionalism in the world. So we could think about publicly taking responsibility for the legacies of our foreign wars. So, for example, we could apologize. We don't do that, but we could change. And maybe this would give us a competitive edge over China's foreign policy, which is currently gifting many infrastructure projects to the states it wants to attract, although with strings attached, whereas we're still involved in fighting and unfortunately killing civilians.
Well, this is one of the interesting things about it. We might as well get into this a little now. But, you know, China's at the fringes of this book, but there's tension in Vietnam over China. It's always been. You know, I don't think many Americans know, right after the Vietnam War, one of the things that China does is start a brief border war with the Vietnamese, the United Vietnam, and China gets their butt kicked because Vietnam has spent, you know, the last 10 years fighting off the Americans. And that did not go the way that the Chinese have wanted to go. And there's still consistent, it's very interesting how the geopolitics have changed now that the United States is much more worried about China and needs Vietnam as a strategic partner. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about, well, you know, what's changed and what's the view about Vietnam, what's the view about China in Vietnam?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we can look at the Vietnam and U.S. Relationship in the context of Vietnam's traditional distrust of China. It's its largest neighbor and has been a millennial foe. Starting in the 3rd century AD, Vietnam was occupied by China on and off for about 1,000 years. So, yeah, they got together during the Vietnam War, but then China punished Hanoi for attacking the Khmer Rouge, who were China's allies in 1979. More recently, China has been buying up land and investing in joint ventures in Vietnam's natural resource sector, and Vietnamese critics fear that China will end up owning big chunks of Vietnam. And then there's the dispute over the contested Spratly Islands that have rich fishing grounds and potential gas and oil deposits. So that's really, really a concern to Vietnam, because if China gains control of some of these islands in the East Sea, they will control Vietnam's shipping lanes and trade. So on one island, Vietnam has been constructing tunnels and coastal fortifications and basically beefing up its defense artillery. So the Spratly Islands are a big source of contention in the region.
Yeah, and I have a friend who works on water and rivers, river protection in general. And one of the other things was the damming of the Mekong River on the Chinese side of the border has been a huge issue because
You're right about that.
It is limiting the amount of water both flowing into an ecologically sensitive area, but also which has been the life source of Vietnamese trade, because a lot of trade goes up and down that particular delta into the interior regions. And it's not just China, it's Cambodia, Laos as well, because that interface along that river. So it's kind of interesting because now, you know, the U.S. administration, when it's a little bit more open, is trying to use these former enemies, right? This former region that we had so much trouble with, as strategic partners, as a bulk word against the against Chinese sort of aggressive capitalism. But there's also something else in here that I thought was fairly interesting, which was how do these veterans view the new government and what they, you know, quote unquote, won in Vietnam? These are the Vietnamese. Now that Vietnam has developed into a centralized capitalist state, right, a la China and those sort of things. I mean, it's not communist in any way, shape, or form. That's the ultimate irony, right? I mean, in either of these locations, it's still technically a communist party, but it's one party oligarchic capitalist rule at some level. And so how do these veterans view, you know, the current state of the country?
Well, I talked to at least one veteran who, Kim Chi, who had been a film actress in Hanoi in the 60s and served with the Viet Cong in South Vietnam for 10 years during the war. And she was very disappointed that victory did not bring what she thought she had fought for, which was to bring social justice, more social justice to Vietnam, more freedom of expression. And she felt that with Vietnam's economic success, disparity in incomes was rising and rural poverty was still huge, and felt very strongly about the fact that she didn't feel that local authorities were doing enough to remedy this. And in protest, she took a really courageous step and she resigned from the Communist Party. And that's a very significant thing to do in Vietnam. And this is a lady who was in her mid-70s. So there is some discontent among the veterans that the government has gone on more of a capitalist road without the social concerns that they have.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. What do you think?
I was surprised to find this.
What surprised me was the level of dissent and the openness of dissent there as well. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, because I find it shocking, you know, a little bit. But maybe that's just a culture I'm a little too far removed from current day Vietnam.
I think it's very much like the China situation. I mean, it seems that there are dissenters at all ages, but there are many who are in the older age group. And that's not a very easy path to follow in Vietnam. I mean, the government does crack down on that and arrests bloggers or anyone advocating democracy. So it's a jail sentence for many dissenters, and it's something that needs to be addressed.
You know, what are some other things that you want readers to take away from this book in particular, other than, you know, the responsibility that Americans have, how do you want them to kind of picture Vietnam? And this, both in the context of the war, but also how we should be interacting with Vietnam today.
I don't know where to start. I would think what I want to say is that, I mean, as anyone who's traveled there, they know that it's an absolutely beautiful country. And the aesthetics are amazing in both art, music, poetry, sculpture, architecture. And those are the really, their belief systems are very interesting to study. The harmony that they project in so many, in spite of their turbulent history, is to be admired. And I think there's just such a positive side to Vietnam that I think that's what I'd like people to take away from this, even though it's a book about war. It's not just about war. It's about people. It's about how people move on. It's about their ability to forgive, or it's about their resilience. And I think that's the positive message is what I hope people will take away with them.
And can you talk a little bit about the stories of forgiveness? That's the other thing that I think really stands out. And there are other anecdotes. It's very interesting.
You know, I've heard this all for years in Vietnam. And the one thing I don't want Americans to take away with them is that, oh, they forgive us, so therefore we don't have to do anything about it.
Right.
So I definitely don't want to get that message across. On the contrary, I think because they forgive us, we should do something about it. And I think it's quite admirable that they do. Why? I've looked into various reasons. Number one, maybe it's because they won. Number two, there's a strong Buddhist belief that anger is and revenge hurts you, not the person you're directing it at. And I also think, in a way, communist propaganda helped them, as did the peace protests in the U.S. during the war. They know that it's not a personal. They're not angry with the American people. They're angry with the government's policies, and they differentiate between the American people and the government. And I think all those three things help them to move on. And I think this culture of forgiveness is very positive compared to, let's say, the situation in the Middle East, where there's a cycle of revenge that's hard to break.
Yeah, it's certainly
open to investigation again, because again I'm a foreigner, so maybe they're just telling me this, but I think it's something that is worth looking into, because it could be a model.
Well, I think it is. I think it's very interesting with that, but it also points to, I think, as you point out, and it's why so it's really important for, I think, people to sort of read the book that you have and these type of books, because I think it just gives such a different perspective, right, vis-a-vis the current conflicts, the inextractable conflicts that we have, right, like in the Middle East or some other things. Culture matters, and circumstance matters is very situational. You can't have a one size fits all policy that sort of emerges. But I'm so sorry, we're out of time. We've been talking to Sherry Buchanan, publisher, editor, and author, and her new book, On the Ho Chi Minh Trail, The Blood Road, The Women Who Defended It, and The Legacy. Before she created Asia Inc., she worked for the Wall Street Journal, the International Herald Tribune in Brussels, Paris, London, and Hong Kong. Thanks for being with us, Sherry.
Thank you, Tony.
For our producer, Clark Price, engineers Elia Fong and Eddie Valencia, thank you for listening. Tune in next time for more of I'll Look Into. Bye, everyone.